You're listening to this week's excerpt from the Dear Prudence podcast. To get the full-length members-only version every week, join Slate Plus at slate.com/prudypod.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudy. Do you think that I should contact him again?
Help.
Help.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Hello and welcome back to the Dear Prudence Show once again. And as always, I am your host, Dear Prudence, also known as Mallory Ortberg. With me in the studio today is no one. With me in the studio today is nothing. With me in the studio today is my own and solitary self. There is nothing standing between me and my loneliness. I am as alone as I was when I was born, as alone as I will be when I die, as alone as we all, in fact, truly are. There is no veneer protecting me this week, convincing myself that I exist in community instead of alone, wandering, adrift. It's just me here, and it's just you. Let's do this. I come to you all first as the type of person who saw this weekend King Arthur in 3D. That's right. I'm one of the 29 people in America who saw this movie. It cost $175 million to make and has, I believe, thus far made $14 million. At least 20 of those dollars are from me. And I made someone go see it who had absolutely no intention of seeing it. So I would like Guy Ritchie at some point to personally write me a thank you note. I love all 3D movies. And I love any movie that's set before the year 1000. Like, the farther back a movie is set, the more I love it. This is why one of my favorite movies of all time was the movie 10,000 BC. And I know you're thinking that I'm thinking of 1 million years BC with Raquel Welch. That's not true. I'm thinking of the much worse 10,000 BC, which came out in 2009 and starred Camilla Bell. I cannot explain it. Like, the best movies in my mind are just set with cave people in three dimensions. So, like, Pompeii 3D, I saw twice. I will absolutely see King Arthur 3D again. It was the most nonsensical thing I've ever seen, and that includes other Guy Ritchie movies. But I just want to take a moment to address what I think Jude Law is doing right now. And what I think Jude Law obviously is in it, he plays Vortigern, because if you're at all familiar with the King Arthur legend, I know that, like me, you thought, man, you know what King Arthur stories need is more Vortigern, the king who barely shows up at the beginning of the story to yell at Merlin and then disappears forever. We really need a movie that just explores the space with that guy. And luckily, this movie does. And it was so much fun to watch him, because all I could think of was that terrible, wonderful show he's on right now, The Young Pope, and just like how the whole point of The Young Pope is literally just like, it's me, I'm the Pope, but I'm young. Does that blow your mind or what? Even though he is like statistically average age for a Pope. But that's besides the point. The point is, I think Jude Law thinks that right now he's pulling a Charlize Theron. Like, I think that's where he thinks his career is going. And, like, Lord bless him, I hope he's right. Like, he thinks the Young Pope is his, like, big prestige thing. I think he's really excited that his hairline is receding a tiny bit, so he's no longer, like, so beautiful that to look at him is to die. And I think he thought this was going to be his, like, Snow White and the Huntsman, which was a movie that, like, did pretty well. And generally, everyone sort of loved Charlize in it. They were like, it's a pretty goofy film, but, like, she seems to be having a great time chewing up all the scenery, looking amazing, just being an all-around, like, bitch goddess. And I feel like Jude Law really wanted to be a bitch goddess in this movie. Time will tell whether or not he succeeded, but it was just really fun watching him and thinking of him just like in his trailer at the end of every shooting day, just being like, but do you think that I channeled Charlize? Like, do you think that I had her energy? Do you think there's something more I could do tomorrow? And everyone just being like, no, man, you did great. You did great. And I guess that's just what I want to leave you all with today. I think Jude Law's doing his best. And so are all of we. Our first question today is not so much a question, but at long last, a reply to my question, you know, are there women out there who kind of habitually don't brush their teeth? For those of you who aren't familiar, I get not infrequently asked questions by people who are in relationships with men where the men do not regularly brush or floss their teeth. There's not some sort of like medical issue going on. There's no sort of dentistry related trauma that might be holding them back. They're just sort of indifferent about dental hygiene. And the partner in question has said, like, please go to the dentist. Please brush your teeth. I don't want to kiss you. It's unhealthy. I'm worried about your well-being. And they're just sort of like, eh, I don't feel like it. And so I've been really curious, like, are there women out there who do this too? And so far, the answer seems to have been no, but we have at last heard from one of them. As you know, I am alone in the studio. And so my producer, this is not a royal we situation, Audrey is going to be reading all the letters so that you are not stuck listening to me and only me for the next 45 minutes to an hour. So those are the tones that you will be hearing. Do not be surprised. I have not lied to you and snuck a guest in at the last minute.
Dear Prudence, I am a wife who has bad brushing habits. I'm in my early 20s, and I'll be the first to admit that I brush probably twice a week at best. It's usually less. Gross, I know, but there it is. The reason it's so hard for me is because it was never pushed in my house as a child. We were day of the dentist brushers, and that's about it. This may be a common thread. The solution will be harder as it requires a desire to change a habit before there can be any change. I'd say therapy or a printout about the side effects of poor dental health would be the most likely solutions. But perhaps, Prudy, you have some other ideas. For me, knowing that my teeth will fall out of my head if I don't do something about it has been a good way to galvanize me.
And I think, first of all, good for you, letter writer. Like, clearly the biggest sort of hurdle in between the people who I get written about and going to the dentist and brushing your teeth is the desire to do so. So the fact that you want to do something different is a great sign. Another thing that's great is brushing your teeth does not take very much time. It's not like building a new habit, like going to the gym every day where you have to like put on a new outfit and drive somewhere and pay a sign-up fee and like take a couple of hours out of your day. You can just start doing it in your own home, and that's fantastic. And when it comes to adding a new habit, like there's kind of a lot of different ways that can make it likelier to stick. One is to automate it. So I think if you can set an alarm on your phone, if you're the kind of person who responds to those at the same time every day, that just reminds you to brush your teeth and sets a timer for like a full 2 minutes so that you don't really have to think about it so much, like to set up a little toothbrushing station in your bathroom. So you just reach for it and go. There's no sort of like hunting around for like, where did I put the toothbrush last week? That can be really, really helpful. There's a lot of stuff out there. You can sort of do research about like habit changes. I think there's a sort of like acronym that's very popular, which is like SMART, which is that your resolution has to be specific, measurable, have a reward, and be trackable. I guess there's no A in it. Maybe there's an A and I just forgot it. Basically, you kind of already have all of those goals met, which is great. It's like a small habit. And if you automate it, if you're kind of tracking your progress, generally it seems like around 90 days is when a habit sort of shifts from something you have to think a lot about to something that feels like a part of your everyday natural life. Then it doesn't really require a lot of self-control or like internal debate. You can just go for it. And that's fantastic. So start small. Just try to brush twice a day. You don't need to throw flossing at yourself just yet. Like, get 90 days of teeth brushing in and like maybe do a little reward for yourself and then start adding floss in later. And you can maybe do something fun, like play a few minutes of a podcast or watch a few minutes of a show that you like or whatever it is that you sort of enjoy to sort of incentivize yourself. You can like tell your partner, tell other people in your life. Like, obviously, it's kind of a personal thing to discuss with other people. So if you don't feel comfortable saying to your friends, like, I'm finally going to start brushing my teeth regularly, you don't have to. But sort of have somebody who is like there for you, excited to help you chart your progress. Yeah. And congratulations. I just think this is something really good for you. You're still young. You're in your early 20s. This will be good for you over the course of your life. It will keep your dentist bills down. It will help your, heart health. You're going to be glad you did it. You will have fewer cavities, and good for you. And thank you for writing in. Congratulations. Write us back, by the way, in 90 days and let us know how it's going. I'm serious. I really want to hear from you again, letter writer. Like, good for you. Awesome. Fabulous. So, our first question of the day is about when to ask for exclusivity in dating.
Dear Prudence, I recently have started dating only doctors or guys in med school. I started this habit after going on date after date with scrubs. I've never dated a ton, but I know I like a motivated and smart guy, so this assures at least that. At the age of 25, I've risen to the top of my field and have a lot of successes. So I want someone to keep up with me. God, that sounds vain, I know, but you should see some of the men I've gone on dates with. My problem is the doctors I've gone out with all have busy schedules. I'm fine with this, but I do want some sort of commitment. Can I make it clear to them that while I want exclusivity, I don't necessarily want more time commitment without scaring them off? Just a relationship without stress, but also without the worry of him dating other people. Is that even possible?
I just need you all to know, by the way, I had to read this, I think, 4 times before I realized that when they said they'd been going on date after date with scrubs, they meant it like in terms of the TLC song No Scrubs and not guys wearing scrubs, because this question is all about doctors and medical professionals. So I was like, you were accidentally going on dates with a lot of doctors wearing scrubs and you liked it so much you decided to make it a policy? Like, this just confused me a lot. It really threw me for a loop. So they were going out with, this letter writer was going out with a lot of guys who were just no good. And now they have this doctor policy, which is fine. You know, certainly there are smart and motivated people who did not go to medical school, but if it's really important to you to date a lot of doctors or soon to be doctors, like that is a thing you can do as a human being. I salute you. I hope you are looking for some other attributes as well, but fine, great. Like, this is a policy that you can have. One of the trade-offs of dating people in medical school is that they are incredibly busy, and many of them may not be looking for a relationship, even if you were to assure them that you would only need, you know, an hour of their time a week, which is also fine. It's also fine to know that, like, what I want is to date with an eye towards exclusivity and commitment, but not necessarily someone who I'm going to see 6 nights of the week or even 4 nights of the week. And that's what I want. That might be a little tricky, like between being a doctor or in medical school, wanting exclusivity and only wanting to see you once or twice a week. It's definitely what you're asking for is specific, but I think possible. And I think you should just let them know up front. You know, you don't have to say this on the very first date, but you should absolutely say, you know, ideally, I would love to meet somebody that I could be in an exclusive relationship with. And ideally, we'd see each other once or twice a week. That's it. That's all you have to say. If the guys that you say this to don't want that, then there's not like a better way you can frame it so that they will instead want the thing you want. It just means they're not looking for what you're looking for. And some people will probably hear that and think, you say you don't really want a lot of my time, but if you want exclusivity, I'll feel bad if I'm not giving it to you. So it might not work for them. But I think the most effective way to get what you're asking for is to just state it pretty frankly. And, you know, good luck finding the low-key, exclusive doctor boyfriend of your dreams. This next one is, oh, I like these. These are just nice and simple answers. This next one, I have, I think, like a 2-word answer for. The subject line is just to cut or not to cut.
Dear Prudence, I have a crazy neighbor. His house is falling down around him. Birds and woodland creatures make homes in the holes in his siding. Vines grow through his roof. I've only seen him 5 or 6 times in the last 10 years, but any polite hello I have offered has been shot down. That said, he's quiet, leaves me alone, and I'm happy to leave him to his life. He's a fine neighbor in my book. However, one of the trees on his side of our property line died about 5 years ago. It recently started leaning on the fence between our yards. I tried pushing it away, but it won't fall into his overgrown yard. Can I just cut it down at the fence line? It will fall into my yard and I'm happy to deal with it. He'll just be left with the fence height stump on his side. His backyard is a jungle of vines and overgrowth that he has never even entered, so I'm sure he wouldn't notice. I know I should go talk to him and get permission, but 1, he's made it very clear that I should not talk to him, and 2, it's a dead tree, dead for 5 years. Am I morally in the clear to chop that sucker down?
Don't worry about morality. Worry about city laws. Call 311. 311 in most cities is the non-emergency line for city services. And there you can speak to someone at like city planning and say, am I allowed to cut down this dead tree that is starting to fall across my fence? And depending on the city you live in, they will either say, yes, you do not need permission, cut with glee, or they will say, yes, but you're going to need a permit. And then you can get a permit, or they'll say, no, you need written permission. And then you'll have to go get that. Some trees are protected trees, and even if they are dead or dying or falling down, you are not allowed to cut them down without contacting the city first. So don't worry about your neighbor just yet. Call your city's non-emergency line. Find out what you have to do in order to not get in trouble to cut down this tree, and then go ahead and do it. Cut it down. Have a great time. Have like a tree cutting down party. You have waited 5 years. Make the call. Figure out what you need to do. Don't worry about morality. Just worry about getting in trouble with the city, which is not something I ever want for any of you. We've got another one about dating.
Dear Prudence, I'm a 30-year-old single female who has just entered the dating world for the first time in 7 years. I feel like I've emerged from a time capsule into a world I don't exactly understand. I would like to find a solid, lasting relationship, but this whole dating thing is beyond me. What are the norms? Sleeping with somebody on the first date? Is that an instant blacklist situation where a man will no longer take you seriously? Seems a little sexist if so. Or, in the age of constant communication and social media, how much is either too much or too little texting? Does a text only once every couple of days imply disinterest? How often, as busy professionals with existing work and social lives, should somebody be trying to make plans to see you? Are men always expected to pay? I consider myself an attractive, successful, down-to-earth, and interesting woman, but the advice I get about red flags seems old-fashioned. That men should be pursuing and trying to charm women with expensive dinners and elaborate dates. I don't need a lot of fanfare from men. I'm laid back and essentially enjoy just good conversation and red wine. However, I don't want to be so laid back that I end up being disrespected or reading too much into a he's just not that into you situation. I'm struggling to walk this line.
Well, letter writer, I think I can say with reasonable confidence that you do not live in the Bay Area, because I am trying to imagine a world where people say to one another things like, men should be buying women expensive dinners. And I'm sure that still exists. Like, I'm sure that's actually like kind of a norm in parts of the country still. But I bet you don't live in Oakland, which maybe you should move. Come here. All anyone here wants to do is casually get burritos and be in bed by 11 p.m. It's pretty great. Unless you don't like that sort of thing, in which case I imagine it's very, very frustrating. So some of what you are looking to do, I think I have some expertise on. Some of it, I have no idea. If you're the kind of person who likes to read books about relationships, I think a year or two ago, Aziz Ansari, the comedian, the actor, wrote a book with a sociologist called Modern Love that I remember being a lot about the sort of things you brought up of like, what's the deal with texting? And it was like a fairly funny, but also well-researched book. You may find it helpful and comforting. I was ready to laugh a little bit about the 7 years thing, and then I remembered like Tinder came out in 2012. So like the last time you were dating people, there were not like dating apps on people's phones, and that's a pretty big jump. Like that was a definite shift, even from like the, you know, when you were last dating in 2010. Like OkCupid was definitely a thing, and a lot of dating sites were really successful, but there wasn't quite that same sense of like everyone's on your phone. So there is a shift. Some of this is just you were in a relationship for 7 years, and so you're just going to feel weird because dating is different from being in a relationship. So some of this you need to just accept is going to be a part of the next phase of your life. There are places and people wherein sleeping with someone on the first date is super normal. And there are places and people where it is not. I'm afraid I don't have like one size fits all advice for you. In my own circles, I don't know anyone who would say if they slept with someone on the first date that that meant they would not consider dating them. But that's not to say there aren't people who might feel that way. So I think the best advice I would have for you is just ask yourself if you would like to sleep with this person on your first date. And if the answer is yes, you know, go with God. And if the answer is I'm not sure, wait a little while. You can always have sex later. Sex can be eternally postponed. There's literally no reason you can't just have sex the next time you see someone. So you can kind of put it off as long as you want to. Again, I'm sure there are some men who sleep with someone on the first date and then think, now she is not serious, but I can't really imagine what that kind of person must be like. Can't really imagine wanting to date them. Maybe they have other great qualities. Yeah, I would say don't worry too much about that. There is such a thing as too much texting. There is also such a thing as too little texting. Again, your mileage may vary. If somebody texted me once every couple of days and we had started dating each other, I would assume they hated me and I would run away to the moon. That's just me. I'm a delicate hothouse flower. I require a fair amount of attention. If you feel happy about the amount a person is texting you, that's great. If whenever you text them, especially about the possibility of spending time together and they kind of vanish for 24 hours, it's not a great sign. And I don't think you should work too hard to excuse it. Like, I think generally we know if someone seems excited about us. And that doesn't always mean that they're banging down our door, you know, at midnight. But if someone seems generally enthusiastic about talking to you and about seeing you, you know, within a reasonable time frame of your last date, whether they choose to do so via the medium of texting or some other form of communication, that's great. Are men expected to always pay? No. I mean, no. I don't even think among, like, exclusively heterosexual, kind of old-fashioned people, there's still an expectation that a guy should always pay. I think at most you'll see someone who says, you know, I kind of like it on the first couple of dates if the guy at least offers to pay. But I think you should not go into a dating situation, unless you know someone to be pretty old-fashioned, assuming someone's going to pay for you. I think you should always bring enough money to cover your share of the bill. And you should always offer to pay. And you should always offer to pay in good faith. So I don't think you should do the sort of, oh, can I help with a check? In that kind of tone of voice that's like meant to let somebody know, do not take me up on this. If you do, you will have failed a test. Generally, I think the best rule is just whoever did the inviting should treat. And it's kind of nice to treat somebody and to be treated. But it's also fine to go Dutch a lot of the time. If it's really important to you to meet a guy who, at least in the beginning, will offer to pay more often than you do, you know, that's fine. That's fine to look for. I don't think that's like evil, but just be aware that that's not really common. I genuinely don't think it's super common for like a guy to always pay. And so I don't want you to think that if you're seeing a guy you otherwise like who is not offering to buy you everything, that he is actually a jerk or somehow disrespectful. I don't think that that's the case. You know, yeah, it does sound like the advice about red flags you're getting are old-fashioned, that guys should always be pursuing and trying to charm you with really elaborate dates. Like, obviously, it's great when someone pursues you, right? It's great to feel like someone's excited to see you, that they care about, you know, getting to know you better, that they want to, like, you know, please you and see you have fun. That's fantastic. But do you need to worry if you meet a guy and you really like him and he really likes you and he's not racking his brains till 3 a.m. every night to figure out, like, what, I don't know, flash mob he can get started at a museum to parachute you to Brazil? Yeah, like, no. You're a human being trying to meet other human beings. And unless it's incredibly important to you that somebody always be, like, trying to keep you on your toes, if somebody just wants to, like, go out to meals and take walks and watch movies and make out, that is fine. That is not a problem. So I guess that's the bulk of my advice. Don't worry too much about who's doing the paying. Sleep with someone when you want to and not before. If somebody doesn't take you seriously after you have sex with them, that says something about what they think about having sex with them means, and you should probably not try to spend more time with them. Texting is great, but it's not everything. Do your best. Good luck out there. Have a great time. Maybe stop listening to your friends so much who, like, demand that men parachute in from the trees and throw champagne at your feet. But yeah, have a good time. Good luck. Guys, we got another letter about sperm donation.
Dear Prudence, I've been with my boyfriend for about 4 years. We have a fantastic relationship and we're in it for the long haul. Recently, he had dinner with a longtime friend who is a straight single female. We're a gay couple. During the meal, she discussed her desire to have a child, with him as the known donor. He said he was open to this. They've apparently discussed it before, but never in any definite or serious terms. Afterward, he told me and asked what my thoughts were. I told him I was against it. I explained that beyond the legal risks and unclear nature of what his role would be in the child's life, I didn't like the idea of him having a child with somebody else while we're together, regardless of the arrangement. To me, it seems like an intimate commitment with another person and something I would obsess over. He was surprised I had such strong feelings against it. We discussed it at length, and he said that ultimately if I was still against it, he wouldn't do it. I don't see myself changing my mind on this, but I'm willing to discuss and get other perspectives. I think his friend is a wonderful person and probably low risk for any drama resulting from such an arrangement. Still, the idea that he's in a committed long-term relationship with me and would have a child with somebody else is unsettling to me. We'd like to have kids of our own eventually. I know that these arrangements exist and function, but am I being unreasonable? Any perspective would be helpful.
I find it charmingly naive that your boyfriend was surprised you would have strong feelings about him having a child with someone else. Having a child with someone is sort of one of the most personal things a person can do, even if you are not in a romantic relationship with them and even if you are not going to be taking an active parenting role with them. It makes a lot of sense that your partner, who knows you personally, would maybe have a strong opinion about such a personal choice. I think it's fabulous that your boyfriend is talking about it with you and wants to take your view into account. I think you are right to feel a great deal of trepidation about it. There are a number of ways things can go really, really pear-shaped with known sperm donation. That doesn't mean it's a bad idea 100% of the time or that no one has ever done it and found it meaningful and helpful and uplifting and profound. But you run into a lot of higher risk areas than you do with going with a sperm donation from a clinic. As you yourself pointed out, there are a lot of legal risks. There's a lot of different ways that the situation can go wrong and pretty much just one way it can go right. There is always a sense at the beginning of, well, we're friends and we care about each other. So obviously we'll just always talk it out and none of us will ever kind of go off the deep end and try to sue for child support or, demand custody of a child that we previously said we were really comfortable relinquishing our parental rights for. Like, again, there's just not to say that your boyfriend or his friend are about to do those things, just that those things happen and that it's a lot harder to sign away parental rights and responsibilities than you might think. And there are still a lot of ways in which people who said at the beginning, it's okay, I'll never need you for child support, later maybe lose a job or, run into some difficulties and really, really need money to help raise the child. And things change. So yeah, I think it's very, very reasonable for you to have the sort of standard issue concerns. I also feel pretty strongly that it's everyone's sort of right to make their own reproductive decisions, and that it is also a good idea if you want to stay in a relationship with someone that you see yourself with long term to take their opinion into consideration. That doesn't mean you have to do the things that they want, but it does mean that I think it's really good to talk to and listen to one another. So if your boyfriend feels really comfortable saying, you know, if you, my partner, are against it because I am committed to spending my life with you because someday I want to have and raise children with you, if that would be a deal breaker for you, I will not do it. And I think that that's good. And I don't think that, you know, it's great that you're trying to consider all possible angles here, but especially since you two are considering having children of your own together someday, like that would be a lot to say, yeah, we're going to have, you know, our kids will have half siblings that they may not be in contact with, or, you know, that's a lot for me to think about. That would be hard for me to deal with. And it doesn't mean that his friend will not be able to have children. You know, she does have a lot of options. She could ask an unattached person. If she wanted to go with a known sperm donor, she could go through a sperm donation clinic. She does have other options. It's not like if your boyfriend does not give her his sperm, that's her last chance to have a biological child. So there's that to bear in mind. And he also, you know, he's not committed to anything. They've talked about this possibility before. That's all they've done. They haven't signed a contract, which I can't imagine would be legally binding. They haven't done anything, you know, that you can't take back. She's not already pregnant. They've just talked about the idea before, and you've been with him for 4 years. You guys are building a life together. You're going to have a family of your own someday. And if you just absolutely can't see yourself being comfortable with this, I think that's pretty appropriate to say. And if your boyfriend is willing to not do it for the sake of preserving your relationship, then I think that is a fair thing to ask for. And yeah, it doesn't mean that you hate his friend. It doesn't mean that you think she's going to turn into a monster. It just means that you're aware that this is a hugely fraught situation with a lot of different like legal and relational possibilities. And it's not a risk that you're willing to run. And you would prefer that he not do it. So, you know, I would certainly also encourage you to do a little research about the risks of known sperm donation, maybe consult a lawyer, not because you're about to hire somebody to defend you in court, but just to kind of get a sense of how often do these situations go south and what do people do to protect themselves and does it work? And what are the ways in which this particular situation could sour and what would that look like for us? Just so you feel like, oh, I did my research. I know what's going on. But yes, at the end of the day, you have a right to say that you're not comfortable with this. And I think it's great that your boyfriend wants to make this decision as a unit because you two are a committed couple that plans on, you know, being together and making your decisions with one another's input. So go ahead. Don't feel bad about this. If this is a deal breaker for you, if this is a hard limit you need to set, set it. So the subject line of this one is, I bought my son's girlfriend a pregnancy test.
Dear Prudence, my son is a senior in high school and has been seeing a girl for a few months. I like her a lot, but she's a little broken, aren't we all? A month ago, she snuck out of her house and was sexually assaulted by a friend. 3 weeks later, she's afraid she's pregnant. It would not be my son's. My son confided in me what was going on. His girlfriend came with us to a family event the other night, and before I took her home, I bought her a pregnancy test. I gave her the choice of taking it at my house, but she opted to take it home. Yesterday, I received a text message from her mom. Did you buy my daughter a pregnancy test? I admit I hesitated before responding, but it's not like I bought her drugs or booze, so I responded with yes, I bought the test. Now I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop. I've bought them for a friend of my daughter's before as well. I don't feel I'm doing anything wrong, and I like that my kids can confide in me about this without being judgmental or disapproving. So why do I now feel guilty? Was there a better way to handle this?
Oh, man. So I want to start by saying I am not super up on laws state to state. I imagine if your son is a senior, it's possible that his girlfriend is also a senior. She may be 18. She may be 17, depending on what state you live in. They may be considered legal adults. I'm not aware of a state where it is illegal to buy a pregnancy test for a minor. It's not like birth control or contraception. It's just a pregnancy test. So I don't believe that you could have gotten yourself into any legal trouble. Although, again, I will freely remind everyone, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not close to a lawyer. I've never even been inside of a law school. So you will want to do a little more research about that. I don't think that you were wrong to buy this girl a pregnancy test. You do ask, was there a better way to handle this? And I think that there may have been. I don't know if you guys also had a long and extensive conversation about her assault and how she's doing, but if you found out that she was sexually assaulted and your only response was to buy her a pregnancy test, then I think you failed to demonstrate empathy and compassion in a pretty profound way to a young person who had just been sexually assaulted. So, no, I don't fault you for getting her a pregnancy test. I think that that was probably a caring thing to do. It's important for her to know if that's something that she's afraid of. But if you have not already, I would suggest speaking to her again and just letting her know that you are here for her, that you care about her, that she did not deserve to be assaulted, and that if she would ever like help either reporting the assault or speaking to like a crisis counselor or even like calling the National Sexual Assault Hotline. It's run by RAIN, the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. It's available 24/7. It's free. It's confidential. The number is 1-800-656-HOPE. That's 1-800-656-HOPE. So that she can speak to someone who is trained in helping survivors of sexual violence. I think that that is as important, more important than simply meeting her physical needs, like helping her figure out if she is or is not pregnant, but meeting her emotional needs, her needs for justice, her need for care. I hope that you have perhaps done this already and simply didn't mention it. But you know, if you find out that someone has been sexually assaulted and all you do is say, here's a pregnancy test, you've missed an opportunity to help someone. I think regardless of whether or not her mother gets mad at you, to let this girl know that you are here for her, that you are so sorry that this happened to her, and that if she would like to report it, if she would like to be put in touch with a crisis counselor or a therapist, if she would like to just speak with someone who can help her kind of figure out what she needs and how to process this, that you're there for her. And be willing to back that up. I think that's just as important as being willing to buy somebody a pregnancy test. And I also hope that your son did not violate her confidence and trust in telling you this. You know, it's kind of unclear in this letter what this girl thinks and feels about everything that's been happening around and to her. And if she is okay with the fact that your son shared this information with you, that's all well and good. But I would check in with her, and I would not share this information with other people. Consider this very confidential. I hope your son was not just sort of telling you even after she had asked him not to. I hope both of you really can prioritize what she wants and what she needs in this moment, and not to try to push her to make one or another choice, but to let her know whatever she decides that she needs, you will support her in doing. I think maybe the reason you feel guilty is not that this girl's mom might get mad at you for buying a pregnancy test, but because you have incompletely and insufficiently responded to someone in pain. And I think that's where the guilt is coming from. And that doesn't make you a monster. A lot of times we are surprised by our own responses to things like violence and assault and sexual violence. And we don't know what to do and we're taken aback. But you have a real opportunity right now to correct that and to go back to her and to really respond with compassion and attention and care and to really stress how awful what happened to her was, and that you are here for her whatever she needs, not just her physical needs, but her emotional and spiritual and mental needs as well. Regardless of whether or not you get in trouble with her mother. And I don't know if she told her mother about it. I don't know if her mother found the test. Again, there's like a lot we don't know about this girl's safety, both in her own home and with her friends, how she's being treated, whether or not she feels like she has sufficient confidentiality and privacy. You'll know that better than me, but make sure she knows that you are going to keep her confidence if she shares things with you, that you're not looking to judge or restrict her options, and that you want to help and support her. And I think that's the most important thing that you can do. And I hope your son is doing that as well, because this is pretty huge and pretty awful. I think there's more work to be done here. And I think that will go a long way toward assuaging your guilt. And I think there's more you need to do. And I hope that you are able to do it. And I just wish that girl the best. And I hope that you're able to care for her meaningfully. Thanks. Now that I have heard from at least one woman who has not regularly brushed her teeth as an adult but plans on changing, I have a new call. Although, please, again, feel free if you are another one of these women. I've only heard from one of you. I would love to hear from more. I want to put out another call for a question that I would like to have answered. One of the things that my Tahila, Nicole Cliff, and I have always disagreed upon is where a person should sleep. I don't mean like on a bed or like in an eagle's nest. I mean like the position a person takes when they fall asleep. She always thinks it's incredibly strange that I sleep on my back. I think she has more than once referred to it as sleeping like a witch because I sleep, to me, what feels like the classic sleep position, which is like head on a pillow, back, arms at your sides. I don't know, corpse pose, like just you sleep like you've just fallen down. Like, that's how you sleep. That's what sleeping is. I might occasionally, if I'm tossing and turning, hang out on my side for a few minutes, but I'm not going to fall asleep there. That's impossible. And I'm so curious because I know apparently there are people who can sleep on their stomachs. Who are you? Are you witches? Are you wizards? What is it like? How do you fall asleep with your face smashed into a mass? Like, how do you how do you not suffocate? And if you turn your head to the side so that you can breathe, how is it comfortable to sleep with your spine at a 90-degree angle all night? What do you... How do you do this thing? I genuinely do not understand how a human being can fall asleep in any position other than the position I fall asleep in, the correct position, the only way to sleep, the best way to sleep. And I would like to hear from you. How do you do it? What does it feel like? Doesn't your nose get smashed into your brain from putting it down? How? Can I come to your house and watch you sleep? That's weird. I realized as soon as I said it that was weird. Do you all sleep on massage tables that have the little hole for your nose at the top? Will you send me footage of you sleeping? Oh, that's still creepy. I'm sorry. Again, drawings. Here we go. Send me drawings of yourself sleeping and 100 words or less describing what it feels like and why it's wrong and why I'm right, and you're going to stop immediately and start sleeping the way I do. I'd like to thank you in advance, both for bearing with my creepiness and also for sending me these weird drawings. Thanks for listening to Dear Prudence. Our producer is Audrey Dilling. Our theme music was composed by Robin Hilton. Remember, you can always hear more Prudence by joining Slate Plus. Go to slate.com/plus to sign up. If you want me to answer your question, call me and leave a message at 401-371-DEAR. That's 3327, and you might hear your answer on an episode of the show. You don't have to use your real name or location, and at your request, we can even alter the sound of your voice. Keep it short, 30 seconds, a minute tops.